Good morning.
Good morning.
So this morning we are in John chapter 13, and we're going to be looking at verses 1 through 16. We're continuing to learn more about our church's theme for this year, sharpening our focus by becoming more like Jesus. And so this morning what we're going to look at is an episode in the story of Christ where Jesus demonstrated servanthood and humility. And we're going to kind of examine that a little bit and look to see what can we take from this episode, this story, and apply to how we serve others. But before I even get into that, I want to tell you, this passage, this whole idea, assumes that as a believer, you already know you should be serving people. That's not what we're going to preach on. I'm just going to take for granted that you are mature enough believers that you know that God has called you to serve others. I believe that as this church already knows that, we're not even going to deal with that. I'm just going to go to the next point of the idea, and we're going to talk about how to do that and why to do that. So I want to read this passage to you first, and we'll get into it. It says, this is John 13, starting at verse 1. It says, before the Passover celebration, Jesus knew that his hour had come to leave this world and return to his Father. He had loved his disciples during his ministry on earth, and now he loved them to the very end. It was time for supper, and the devil had already prompted Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. And Jesus knew that the Father had given him authority over everything, and that he had come from God and would return to God. So he got up from the table, took off his robe, wrapped a towel around his waist, and poured water into a basin. And then he began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel he had around him. And Jesus came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus replied, you don't understand now what I am doing, but someday you will. No, Peter protested, you will never wash my feet. And Jesus replied, unless I wash you, you won't belong to me. Simon Peter exclaimed, then wash my hands and my head as well, Lord, not just my feet. And Jesus replied, a person who has bathed all over does not need to wash except for the feet to be entirely clean. And you disciples are clean, but not all of you. For Jesus knew who would betray him. And that is what he meant when he said, not all of you are clean. And after washing their feet, he put on his robe again and sat down and asked, do you understand what I was doing? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, because that's what I am. And since I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought to wash each other's feet. I have given you an example to follow. Do as I have done to you. I tell you the truth. Slaves are not greater than their master, nor is the messenger more important than the one who sends the message. This passage is very visual, for me at least. It's a very interactive story. And recently I've been doing some studies. The Super Saints have heard some of it, and the youth and I have been going through. And I've been sort of challenged with this idea to sort of re-examine Jesus' ministry with the disciples by some books I was reading and stuff like that, that actually the disciples were much younger than I originally realized. That they're actually, you know, probably at this time, they're probably somewhere like 20 years old when the story is told. And throughout most of Jesus' ministry, they're like older teenagers. And John especially was very young. And I'd always had in my head the picture of these guys from the movies that have beards and things like that. And there's a whole bunch of evidence to suggest what I'm saying. But reality is people just didn't live that long. And so if these guys were in their 40s when they followed Jesus, by the time they write their books and you're getting tortured, they're being in their 80s or 90s. Like, it's just, it doesn't even make sense if you really think about it. And there's a whole bunch of more evidence to suggest that. But after I've been doing this study, I begin to really see Jesus and begin to remind me of my experience as a youth pastor. And it's interesting, once you start to see the disciples kind of in that light, a lot of what they say and what Jesus says makes a lot more sense. Like, when they're arguing about who's going to be first in the kingdom, like, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense for, you know, grown men to do that, but, well, maybe some guys, but teenagers do that stuff a lot. And this is kind of one of those stories, and so when I look at this passage again, how many of you guys have seen that movie? It's been a few years since it came out, but the Hobbit movies? You guys see those movies? Okay. I actually hadn't watched them until just a few weeks ago. I'm a big fan of that type of stuff, but I just never got around to it. Actually, when they were in theaters the first time, Kim and I were in the theater watching them, and Bob called me in the middle of the theater because he had an issue and he needed me to preach that Sunday. I just never watched him again. So I don't know what that means. but anyways, no, it's not your fault. They've been out. But anyways, I watched him a few weeks ago. And one of the reasons I'm bringing it up is because there's several scenes throughout the whole trilogy where Gandalf is, because he's bringing this like little group of dwarfs on this mission. And there's 14 people in all in their party, or 15. And every so often he'll stop and he'll go, 1, 2, 3, Balin, Dwalin, 14, okay. And he's keeping track of the group and making sure they're all still there. And I do that all the time with our students. Kim and I have always done that. So especially like when we were in Denver a few months ago, every so often we'd stop and go, okay, 1, 2, 3. Oh, where's Anthony? Because invariably it's him, and he's off. And I have to go, Anthony, I found this guy, and I'm going to share the gospel with him. Like, that's great, but we have to be over here. Our plane is leaving. But you brought me here for this, Nate. I did, but I also intend to bring you back. If it was up to Anthony, he'd have never left. He'd have stayed there witnessing for the whole time. But I'm always kind of doing that. This is kind of how I picture Jesus coming into this house. The disciples come in, and everyone. And it's interesting because we always see them sitting in chairs, but in reality, in that culture, they sat on the floor. They may have had pillows, but they'd sit on the floor, and the table was very low to the ground. So these boys come in, these young men, and they sit around this table, and Jesus comes in, and I just imagine him going, okay, they're all there. Just, okay, Peter's here too. And just kind of being okay with that. And then there's this other thing that he sees, and it's this empty, unused washing basin that's next to the door. See, in this culture, everyone walked around in sandals all the time, and they walked around in the dirt all the time. And people's feet were really dirty. And so it was actually customary that when someone came into your house, you had this, it was like a ceremony, you had this washing basin always by the door with a pitcher of water next to it and a towel so you could wash their feet. Because one, it was just a matter of like being polite and receiving them into your home. I took to throw a party. Paul, this guy's barefoot up on the chair. It's not a demonstrative sermon. I'm not going to come do that. But could you imagine throwing a house party and before you do, you got to wash everyone's feet on the way in? But the other side of that, too, is you just don't want those dirty feet all over your house. You know, so it was kind of both sides to it. But it was actually the responsibility of the owner of the house. So whoever was hosting this party, whoever owned the house, whoever was there hosting the Passover should have done this as they came in. But they didn't. We're not really told why, and I guess the only thing I can come up with is maybe that he's just busy setting up the tables for these, you know, 12 to 15 people who are coming in to eat dinner. Maybe he just got behind. Anybody ever serve food and get behind? Like, if you throw a party and get behind, you gotta make all that up. Maybe he just figured, well, there's like 12 young men out there. Any one of them could do that. Let's just let them do it. Wash their own feet. I don't know, but nothing happened. If the owner of the house wasn't going to do it, for whatever reason, you have Jesus, who is a rabbi, and his disciples, these young men. One of his disciples should have taken it upon themselves to wash at least Jesus' feet. Andrew may have told John, you're on your own, but I'm going to wash the master's feet. Because it was just their responsibility. It was their place out of respect. But instead, what you see is something that I'm very, very familiar with. And anybody who has teenagers has seen this too, where they come in, and if there's an empty seat, they've got it. And don't ask them to get up because you're tired. And they come in and sit down, and within seconds, they're talking about the latest YouTube video or video game or whatever it is they do in Jerusalem at this time. And they're just talking and being silly teenagers and having a conversation. And everyone in the back of their mind is going, well, I think so-and-so is going to do that. And it's like the teenager that passes the full trash can on the way right through the front door. It's in the kitchen and just goes straight past it and goes, well, somebody else will do that. And they know that this work needs to be done. And they see it, but either they've trained themselves not to do it or they just assume somebody else is going to do that. And they just kind of live in that. And they go on to just being themselves and having a good time. And so Jesus, after making sure everyone is in there and, you know, being the rabbi and being responsible, looks and realizes that none of them are going to do this. This really simple matter of respect. No one's going to do it. They're all just sitting there. And any one of them could have done it. Peter is kind of considered, you know, one of the leaders of the group. And James, and John, these guys, they could have done it. But none of them, none of these great disciples get up and do this. And so Jesus doesn't even say a word. He doesn't scold them. He would have been within his right to be like, John, wash some feet. He would have been totally within his right. But instead, Jesus just quietly goes over to the basin, picks it up, takes off his outer garment, and gets on his knees and kind of waddles around the floor and washes the feet of the disciples. They're supposed to do this before they even sit down, by the way. So now that they're already sitting and at the table, he has to go around, and it's actually a lot more work. And he just quietly goes and does this. And when he does this, the disciples are filled with this, like, well, I think they have different reactions, but most of them are filled with a sense of shame, this guilt of, I should have done that. I was waiting for Andrew to do it. I never thought Jesus was going to get down there and do that, but he did. So this is kind of the story that we see. So the first point that I want to make and kind of examine here is, why did Jesus serve? There are some really unusual statements that John, the gospel writer, makes here. And the first thing is because he knew his hour had come. In verse 1, it says that Jesus knew that his hour had come to leave this world to return to his Father. This is the first of these really kind of unusual statements, that Jesus is sitting there seeing the disciples just kind of hanging out, and he goes, well, I know it's almost time to go back to God. And his response to these statements is to go wash feet. So the first thing is, he knows his time is coming to an end. So he knows there's a sense of urgency. And I find it very interesting that with that sense of urgency, he decides to go and wash their feet. With that sense of urgency, he decides to serve. Now, later on in this story, he does spend a bunch of time explaining to them, I'm going to be going, this is what the cross means, this is who the Holy Spirit is. But before he does any of those things, he stops and serves them and teaches them about humility first. So that's the first thing, is Jesus knew his hour had come. And just in that same sense, I don't know when Jesus is coming back. I don't know how that even works. Paul knows all about it. You can ask him. He has everything figured out. He knows exactly the day. Or he knows the month, right? Because you can't know the day or the hour. That's what he always tells me. Paul knows all about that. I don't know anything about that stuff. But at some point it's happening, and I'm pretty sure it's closer now than it was when this story was written. And that's enough. That's all I need to know, is that there is a sense of urgency. If you read Thessalonians and other parts of the New Testament, Paul had a sense of urgency about putting away the deeds of darkness because the night is almost over and the day is nearly here. Like, he had a sense of urgency 2,000 years ago. So if Paul was that urgent, we need to be urgent. Okay, regardless of whether or not we think we have time or what our personal take on, you know what the big word for that is? It's eschatology. Right? Yeah, I always mix it up with the other one for church. But yeah, eschatology, the study of the end times. Whatever your personal take on that is, it's soon. And it's sooner now than it was yesterday. And it's coming faster. I don't know how that works, but it's coming. And we have to be about an urgency. So what I think is really interesting is that the devil's urgent. Scripture says that he knows his time is short. So he's after us, right? He's urgent. And anybody who's living for the Lord knows that the devil is urgently seeking whom he may devour. And he is after us. And he doesn't have any problem doing sneak attacks and sending things around the side and sending one attack, and then we think it's over and he comes somewhere else. He has no problem messing with us like that. He will get to us any way that he can. And meanwhile, believers are going, well, when it comes up, I'll deal with it. The devil is at war, and we're just going to church. And church should be a sense of urgency and mission. But too often we approach it like it's not. And so we have to become a people who urgently serve. That's the thing. What he's called us to do in response to the urgency is not what you and I would think of at first. But it's because the time is short, because it's urgent, because Jesus is coming back, because the devil is in full force, serve one another. Creatively serve one another. So it's because of urgency is the first thing. The next thing is because he loved his disciples. Again, in verse 1, it says, he had loved his disciples during his ministry on earth, and now he loved them to the very end. This is, the very end is referring to his death and this betrayal that's about to happen. So he's loved them this whole time, even Judas. Even Judas. He didn't sneak in. Jesus called him, knowing from day one, this is the guy. Even Judas. He brings all of them together, and he loves them so much. And he loves them even in the sense of their laziness, or whatever you want to call it, the betrayal he's about to experience, them all kind of deserting him the next couple of days. Even in all of that, he loves them so much. He loves them to the very end. So he washes their feet. His love for them motivates him to serve. And so we also need to serve people because we love them. We need to get to a place where God fills us with his compassion so much that we care about people. We need to never serve because it's somehow part of who we are. I'm a person, I do this. I serve, I preach. And that makes me a better person and makes me feel good about myself. And you know, it does do that. And that's kind of an added bonus. But we don't do it because of that. We serve others because God has called us to love them. And the third thing, because the Father had given him authority over all things. In verse 3, it says, Jesus knew that the Father had given him authority over everything. I find this fascinating that Jesus, John writes, Jesus knew he had authority over everything, so he took off his outer garment, got on his knees, and washed feet. Because he had authority over everything. It's so out of the box of how we usually think. But because he had authority, he chose to serve others. And the way that I apply that to us is that we serve the one who has authority over everything. That we serve Jesus. And so whatever he's called us to do is when it comes to service, or just anything really, we operate in his authority, never ours. But it's under his wisdom and his ability to get things done. And so as we endeavor to share the gospel, as we endeavor to feed people, as we endeavor to serve people in our church and in our lives and all around the city, however he calls us to do that, as we follow him, we do so under his authority, which means that everything is under his authority. So that when we're trying to have an Easter outreach and we need favorites in the city to get things done, I know that God's going to take care of it however he wants to. I know that we're under the authority of Jesus Christ and nobody else's. And so when we're doing block parties or barbecues and we have to deal with some health code or we have to deal with someone coming in, and sometimes, and Charles can testify to this, sometimes people just come in and they need food, but they've come with an attitude. For some reason, they've brought their anger or their bitterness or their issues of unforgiveness, and they bring that with them to get a bag of food as if it's currency. And before they get their food, they're going to give us a problem. And we have to pray about that because the reality is it's probably not even personal. It probably is just their own issues, and they just decide to aim it at those that are trying to help them. And that's just our sin nature. We all deal with that to some degree, and especially for a person who is not a believer, who's dealing with poverty. Like, you know, what do you expect? But the reality is they come in with that kind of an issue as if they have authority in this situation. They demand more stuff. They want to go first in line. They want to leave early. They want all this stuff. And we have to just remember, no, we're under the authority of Christ. He's called us to do this. And as best as we can tell, we're doing it his way. And so we're just going to call everyone under that same authority. And we're going to choose to love those people regardless of how they come in. And so that's how we do service. That's one of the reasons we do this, because we know that we have the authority from Christ. The next thing I want to look at is, who did Jesus serve? No, I think it's a slug that came up here. Go to the next one. There it goes. Okay. So, yeah, there's the line. I didn't put anything in here because I just explained the story to you. How do you think the disciples were acting? I couldn't think of something I wanted to print on paper about the disciples and put in the bulletin. They were acting a certain way. Someone tell me, seriously. What was it? Snarky. Okay, that's a good, I wouldn't need it. That's my spelling word for the week, Bob. I don't know what that means. I'm kidding, I do. But I mean, anything else? I couldn't think of a word that I thought was polite enough about the disciples to put in the bulletin. What was it? Fuse, okay. Self-centered, yeah. So whatever you feel like they were doing, you write that in, okay? You make your own note about that one. You just said your opinion, how were the disciples acting? Obviously, it wasn't positive. They weren't following through with their responsibility to take care of their master. And they knew better, because it wasn't like this was the first time. And so Jesus served, in this one story, three different people, or three different types of people, I should say. And one of them was the whatever, snarky, disciples. If Bob says it, I can say it. So, the snarky disciples. He served them. Yeah, I feel like sometimes the people that we serve are the ones that don't really appreciate it. And if we're serving for somebody else's thank you, we're going to be left disappointed. Sometimes it'll come, and it's a cool thing when it does. But if you're serving for that, if you're seeking a thank you, if you're done at the end of an outreach, or you've helped somebody across the street, or your neighbor needed some help in the yard work in the backyard, you went over and did that, and when you're done, or you shared the gospel with somebody, and when you're done, no one said thank you, well, welcome to the club. Okay, Jesus wasn't thanked for dying on the cross until way later, okay? So you have to understand, these things, that you can't just do this because someone's going to be so happy and so, they're going to get it. No, usually they won't. Usually we are serving someone that doesn't know Jesus. And I hope we are. And we're serving someone that doesn't understand service. And that's kind of why we do it, isn't it? It's to show them something. And so if we're looking for some kind of a reaction, I was told that years ago when I started youth ministry, I was actually reading a book that was recommended to me. I was really struggling with middle school ministry. Anybody ever volunteered with youth? Middle schoolers are tough. Because they just, it's like they're not even there sometimes. And then sometimes they are, but it's always about something completely different. That's the group that you'll be like really teaching about Jesus and the cross or a story in the Bible. And they're going, I have a dog. And then they're completely off base of what you're talking about. But like little kids will do that too, but I feel like they're more innocent about it. These kids, see, somewhere around 12-ish, you find out that if you can be funny, people will laugh with you rather than at you. And all of a sudden, being funny is all you care about till you're like 17. Okay, and being the funniest is the most important thing. And so if it's funny, they're convinced that it's good. So one of the things I've taught our youth to say, and Jenna probably remembers this, and Richard, is just because something's funny doesn't mean that it's okay. And they all know that little proverb, it's a little Nateism of, yeah, you can laugh at that, but that doesn't make it okay. But oftentimes they think it does. And so they try to be class clowns just in the middle of your lesson, or you're just talking to them all the time. And then they'll want you to help them with whatever crisis they're dealing with. And it becomes so emptying. It empties you because you never, ever get back from them. Or at least if you do, it's very rare. And the book I was reading, it said, if you're waiting for some middle schooler to come up to you and say, thank you for being my youth pastor, get over it. It's never going to happen. Just let that go. You know, and that's a lot of times that's not just a middle schooler thing. That's just a people thing. People, especially people who don't know Christ, actually, not just people, often don't show their appreciation, don't seem to click with what God is doing. And what see, here's the thing. If God is using you to serve, it's obvious to you what's happening because God's using you to serve. But it's not obvious to the person who's getting stuff usually. That usually takes more time. They had to have a sense of maturity to learn that. And so Jesus served these disciples even when they weren't quite getting it. And then I put in here, religious Peter is the next point. He served religious Peter. Now, the word religious, we always use for legalistic, and that's always that's true and it makes sense. That's not really what I mean here, though. What I mean by religious is that Peter is like, he's trying to show that he is the most spiritual in the group. And I feel like he has a sense of pressure to do that sometimes for different reasons. Let me read the little passage again. It says, when Jesus came to Simon Peter, Peter said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus replied, you don't understand now what I am doing, but someday you will. And Peter protested, no, you will never wash my feet. So, like, Peter knows one of the disciples should have done this whole foot washing thing. And then he sees Jesus do it, and he gets over to Peter, and Peter is going, well, I think the lesson here is that Jesus is waiting for one of us to go, oh, no, Jesus, I'll do it, and take it from him and become the servant. And Jesus is kind of going, no, you had the chance for that. I'm busy doing a whole other lesson now, and you don't even get what it is yet. And Peter's going, no, I get it. Like, Jesus, this is wrong, right, John? This is wrong. One of you should be doing this. And Jesus is like, no, Peter, you have no idea what I'm doing. Like, you're completely missing the point. And then Jesus basically says to him, when Peter says no, he says, if you don't let me wash your feet, the version I memorize it in is, you have no part of me, or you don't belong to me. And then Peter is like, well, then bathe me. Wash it all. And that's the other side of it. So, okay, so he does want to wash our feet. Well, then I'll have him wash everything, and I'll be the most spiritual. I'll do the most. I got more of my body washed than you did. And Jesus is like, no, that's not what I'm doing either. You still don't get this at all. You have no idea what I'm after here. But Peter kind of jumps in and out where he's going, well, I think Jesus wants this to be wrong, so I'm saying it's wrong. And in the moment he goes, well, maybe Jesus likes it. Well, let's do it all. And it's religious in the sense that he's just trying to be the best. He's trying to be in front. I don't know if you've ever noticed that or not, but I have many times in my walk seen people, and actually probably been guilty of this myself when I was younger, who look really spiritual, who pursue the most Bible reading or the most prayer time and you know, the most extravagant worship style or whatever the thing is. Not that there's anything wrong with any of those things. But if you're doing it because you feel like this puts you ahead of your brothers and sisters, or somehow makes you like in God's special club, I think it's sort of the difference between John and Peter. John and Peter were both involved in Jesus' what scholars will call his inner circle. So when Jesus goes up on a mountain to do something really weird and unusual, he brings Peter, James, and John only. There's a couple of stories like that, and that's what they call them that. So Peter, throughout the whole story of the gospel, consistently like does the most stuff, as if he felt like he had to earn his spot in that circle, that it was never over. And so he's, you know, later on when Jesus comes back, Peter jumps out the boat and swims to see him, and he has all this different stuff. It's this consistent attitude of, I'm going to be the best disciple. And when Jesus is talking about they're going to arrest me, he gets a sword, and he's ready to fight for Jesus. I'll fight and die for you. And his whole life is like that. And John, meanwhile, is just laying on Jesus' stomach. He's just leaning on him, just being close to him. And like, if you see these, you read the Gospel of John, and John is like really young compared to the other disciples. He has these stories where Jesus is just like, for example, talking to Nicodemus. Jesus is talking to the woman at the well. Those are only in John's gospel. John had these images or these episodes of Jesus when Jesus is apparently one-on-one with somebody else. And the other disciples don't get those moments. And so I kind of feel like that the reason that is that Jesus is like, John, go over there. I'm going to talk to this person now. And John kind of goes over here and hides and either watches or asks for notes later, and somehow he gets privy to these episodes that nobody else saw. And I think that's the issue, is that Jesus had them both in his inner circle, and Peter felt like he had to earn that, whereas John felt like it was just what he was called to be. And he was just so happy to be there. And so, in this case, in this story, Peter is kind of just doing the same attitude, same in and out all the way, be the best, the most against or the most forward. And Jesus is like, all right, I get it. I'm gonna wash his feet. Regardless of his attitude, I'm gonna wash his feet. And the last thing I put down was traitorous Judas. It was time for supper, and the devil had already prompted Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. I have to wonder about this passage. What was Judas thinking? I don't mean why did he choose to betray Jesus, because that's sort of a whole other thing, but what was he thinking when Jesus took a hold of his left foot and removed his sandals? And Judas Iscariot, having already decided in his heart that I was going to do this to my master, and Jesus grabs a hold of his foot and begins to wash it in servanthood. I don't know what he thought, honestly. I've imagined that several times, and I don't know if he had the sort of guilty shame where he just tried to ignore Jesus. I don't know. Or did he have this sense of, this is why I'm killing you? Because you're supposed to be the Messiah. And you take off your robe and you get on your knees and you serve people and you still haven't led us against the Romans. You still haven't stood up to our enemies. You won't be the Messiah. So I'm going to make you. This is exactly why I'm going to trade you in for silver. Because maybe that will make you assert yourself. Maybe there's an arrogance to him. I have no idea. Whatever it was, though, there's this moment of intimacy that I think the disciples, the other ones, just missed, of Jesus choosing to serve someone who chose to be his enemy. A close friend. You ever had a friend turn into an enemy? It's scary how fast that happens, isn't it? Frightens me. Sometimes it's from one day to the next. And it's permanent sometimes. In the case of Jesus and Judas, Judas chose to betray him. He chose to be his enemy. And in the midst of that, Jesus chose to serve him. So if you put all those three things together, enemies and religious people and people who just don't get it, it's kind of just everybody, isn't it? In this one room, Jesus just serves every type of person you can think to throw in this room. He just serves everybody. And I think that's kind of the message is, who does Jesus serve? Everybody. Why? Because God has called him to. I can stop the sermon right there. Serve everyone because God has called you to. That's it. The last thing I want to talk about is how. How did Jesus serve? The first thing he did is by finding a tangible need and dealing with it. It's actually a very simple thing. I'm making a whole big deal about it, but the reality is their feet were dirty. They were visiting somebody's house, so Jesus washed them. I kind of feel like Jesus had that kind of an attitude, too, where he grew up a carpenter. He just was a very matter-of-fact person, where it's just, well, no, there's an issue. We're just going to fix it. Rather than let's have a committee meeting about it and let's think really hard about what we should do. No, I'm just going to wash their feet. They're dirty. I'm going to do that. Move on. Kind of handled things. But as you serve people, it's incredibly important that we see the things that they're really struggling with. So for our church, many times it's food. We have a lot of people in our community who still struggle with food, and they're not necessarily in a place where they can't buy food, but they're in a place where they can't buy food and blank, whether it's medicine. A lot of times it's medicine, or school supplies for their kids, or whatever, where they can't do both. They can't keep up on all their bills and buy food for them and their kids. And so what we're able to do, and it's such a blessing, is to be able to help them with the food part and allow them to use their resources for their other stuff. So, no, buy your kid the backpack. We've got dinner covered. And that's kind of a felt need in our own community. And so what's really cool about it, and I'm sure Bob has seen this a lot more than I have, but in the past 6 years or so, I've been blessed to see this happen a couple of times where some people will actually take us up on our offer and allow us to provide food for them as a regular thing for a long period of time. And if they do that, they're able to take that money. And I've known a couple of homeless people, for example, who have taken the money that they get when they ask for money and saved it. Doesn't happen often, but this does happen. And they've saved it to buy an outfit for that job interview. And they've gone and got a job. And then they've saved that money and still come to us for food, still living in the park with a job, and saved money from that until they had that down payment on an apartment. I know a couple of people that have done that, and they've gotten off the streets. And the important thing is that they were introduced to the gospel and got delivered of their sin issues, because I don't care how much money you give them, if they're still stuck in sin and addiction, they're going to spend it on whatever their problem is, not on getting better in life. And so the gospel has to come first. But it's important that we are actually reaching needs. And so when we share the gospel, I'm kind of skipping ahead of my own notes here, but it's more than one thing. Bob always says it's both and. So we share the gospel by, some people have this thing about saying, you have to be the gospel. And you know what? They're right. You do. But you also have to speak the gospel. It's both and. It's not one or the other. And so it's important that we find something. The word gospel means good news. So what's good news for that person? Is it a church service? Well, it is, but they don't think it is. And maybe right now it's not. Maybe they're mourning someone's death. Maybe they need to be visited. Maybe they need someone to watch their kids. Maybe they need help with their yard. Maybe that would be good news for that moment for them. Now, the ultimate good news is still the gospel. So you never forget those things. But you have to find a felt need, because otherwise they, as lost people, don't quite connect to it. And that's what Jesus did here. He found a tangible need. And the next thing is by sharing the gospel with them. One of the things that I've been really challenged with recently, too, is that Jesus sort of puts the gospel into these episodes, but he doesn't do it in a way that I would notice it at first. And this is one of those moments where I was like, I actually got this from a commentary. It wasn't even Nathan, you know. Nathan's always playing where he's going to find the gospel in this passage. But in this case, it was actually in a commentary that I had, and I didn't even notice it until after I read this. But Jesus has this whole message here that really is the story of the gospel. And he kind of hints at it in verse 8 when he says, unless I wash you, you don't even belong to me. So he's clearly talking about more than just crusty feet. Like something else is happening here. And then he says, the foot washing ceremony is considered a cleansing ceremony in that culture. And it symbolizes, not to them all the time, but in this moment, Jesus used it to symbolize that he's cleansing them of their sins. Now, the disciples, not so much, because they've already had that experience. But it foreshadows the fact that tonight Jesus is washing their feet, but tomorrow he's going to wash their souls. That weekend, he's going to become the thing that washes them. And then especially when he says, do as I have done to you. Now, clearly, he's not telling them to go out and wash everyone's feet. And the reason I know that is because we don't do that. There's no book in the New Testament where John explains how to wash feet right. That's not the ministry Jesus was instituting. What he's saying is, as I've cleansing you, you go and share that with others. And you serve others in this way. I tell you the truth, slaves are not greater than their master, nor is the messenger more important than the one who sends the message. The message. He specifically says message. The message is the gospel. The fact that God loves us and our sins separate us from him, but through his death on the cross, he made a bridge for us to get back to him. He says, a person who is bathed all over does not need to wash except for his feet to be entirely clean. So this is for everyone. This is for the lost and the believer. The gospel is for everybody. That's an important thing that we can't do, is separate the gospel as if it's just for non-believers. It's also for Christians. If you're struggling with sin, the answer is the gospel. It's to be reminded of how you were saved and what saves you and how you fight sin is through the death of Jesus Christ. If you're lost and you don't know him, the answer is the gospel. Okay, it's for everybody. So as we share, we must do both share the good news and demonstrate the good news. And as we do that, God has called us to serve because God calls us to love everyone, even the ones that are tough to love. And so by helping them with their felt need, we also share the good news of Jesus Christ. So it's this continuous thing of basically it's serve because God has called you to, because the time is short. It's serve everyone you come into contact to, regardless of their circumstance, and it's serve them both physically and spiritually through the gospel. And that's how Jesus did it, and that's how we're called to serve. Let's pray.